This is WordPress Weekly, the show dedicated to all things WordPress. Here's your hosts, Jeff Chandler and Sarah Gooding.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to episode 123 of WordPress Weekly for Friday, October 11th, 2013. And, of course, I'm your host, Jeff Chandler. And normally I'd be introducing my co-host, Sarah Gooding, but she's out of town this week, so I'm flying solo. So we'll see how I do on this episode. I apologize if my voice sounds grouchy or scratchy. I'm a little bit under the weather this week. Supposedly, I guess, even remote workers get sick. So trying to nurse it. I'm feeling a little bit better, but we'll just go with the show and see how it ends up. I have a very special guest with me on the show today, but before I get to him, I want to mention some of the headlines this week. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. The main headline I wanted to get out there was that WordPress 3.7 Beta 2 was released. It's now available for downloading and testing. Andrew Nason reported on the WordPress.org development blog that this has been a quiet beta period. They're hoping to get some more testers for the automatic background updates, which will occur for security and minor releases like updating from 3.7 to 3.7.1. He explains that it's really easy to test this. All you have to do is when Beta 2 will update each day to the latest development version and then email you the results. And if something goes wrong, you can report it. It's that simple. So to get the beta, you can use the WordPress Beta Tester plugin and set it up to get Bleeding Edge Nightlies, or you can download the beta from the link that's presented in the dev blog post. Nice to see that 3.7 is pretty much on schedule. And I have a feeling that probably next week we're either going to see, probably going to see an RC, and shortly thereafter the official release of 3.7. And then all the attention is going to turn to WordPress 3.8, which Matt Mullenweg stated would be released sometime in December or near the end of December. So, and he's actually leading that development cycle. So it would be really interesting to keep tabs on that and provide updates as that happens. So that's going to do it for just this week's headlines. So I want to get to my special guest here today because we have a lot to talk about. His name is Scott Birkin. He's a former Microsoft manager during the 1994-2003 time frame where he worked on the Internet Explorer team, and he's author of the book The Year Without Pants. Now, in this book, Scott reports on his challenging year working at WordPress.com as the leader of one of its most important teams, Team Social. The book is a tale of his journey, but it's also filled with advice for managers, executives, and employees alike about how great work is done and what automatic success means for the rest of us. Scott, thank you very much for taking some of your time out of your schedule to be on the show today.
Welcome. Happy to be here and talk about the book.
I've covered WordPress stuff for a number of years now, and I've always been one of those people from the outside looking in terms of automatic. And the only thing I know about is automatic and how they function is talking to automatic employees or reading articles that somehow get an inside look. But your book, The Year Without Pants, actually gives us an in-depth look at what actually is occurring. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration, the idea for the book.
The idea for the book comes, there's a couple different inspirations. One was just that I've been an author guy who gives advice to people for about a decade. I've written four other books. I made my living from being one of these people who speaks at events and gives lots of advice about management or creativity. And I knew that at some point I needed to go back and actually manage a team again and find out how much of the advice I've been giving over these years I actually followed. So I've been looking for an opportunity like this to go back and have a quote-unquote real job again. Working at WordPress.com came about because Matt Mullenweg, I've known him on and off for years. He'd read a couple of my books. We'd exchanged email and done some things. And when his company, Automatic, and the service WordPress.com had gotten big enough, he and Tony Schneider, the CEO, decided they should try to form the company into teams. And as he was thinking of doing that, he thought, well, this Birkin guy, he's kind of familiar with WordPress. He's read my books. So he thought I was credible to be a manager. He offered me the job to come in and be one of the first team leaders. So that was a special opportunity for me as someone who's used WordPress for years. I'm a huge fan to go back to A, solve this problem I had of just wanting to go back to work, but B, it gave me another chance in my career to work on a really important project that I also happened to use. So I could try to get all the bugs and issues that bother me fixed.
The interesting thing about this is even though Matt read your books, you were credible, and you were hired onto the position, they didn't treat you any differently from any normal employee. You still had to go through the 2-week support process, which was an interesting read. Your numbers show that you weren't as good as some of the other people, but you said that that part of the process, the hiring process to work on WordPress.com was very important. You found a lot of value in it.
There is some stuff in the book that the book is really meant to be a story. It's this interesting story of a guy who has this other set of experiences who's now asked to try to manage a team in a very different culture. And I think the biggest strength of the book is that it's just a well-told story about what that's like. But there's lots of stuff that they do that I really recommend other companies emulate. And this is what you're talking about, this support tour, I think is brilliant. So the basic idea is that every employee, no matter what their actual job is going to be, whether they're a lawyer, whether they are a marketing person, a writer, a designer, a developer, it doesn't matter. You have to spend 3 weeks actually working on the happiness team, which is their term for the support team, answering customer tickets and dealing with the actual complaints and issues that customers have. And as you're alluding to, I had a hard time. I didn't do a great job. I was not great at it. But I found the experience of doing it unbelievably valuable. And that helped frame my perspective on what I did as a manager and the kinds of features and decisions that I pushed for were heavily influenced by those 3 weeks. And when I think of all the software companies, not even software companies, I think of all the companies in the world that make lousy products where you used it and you're like, how could this be? How could they really think this is good? That's probably because there's this huge gap between the executives at these organizations and what the frontline experience of the actual customers are like.
Right.
So I'm a huge fan of that process, and I hope that they keep it forever. I think that more companies should adopt it and emulate it because it's a powerful thing.
Now, you used to work at Microsoft before you were hired at Automattic, and Microsoft is not the stewards of open source software. We don't typically think of Microsoft when you say the words open source. What kind of culture shock did you go through after being hired by Automattic?
Well, you know, I never had a problem with open source. Microsoft had a very bad reputation about this. Right before I left, an executive at Microsoft, I think it might have been Jim Altchin, who was the lead executive for Windows for a while, he said something really embarrassing that I remember being embarrassed about at the time. He said something like, I'm not going to quote him precisely, but this is close, that open source software is un-American. He had some quote just about how this notion of making the particular software with a particular philosophy went against American values, and I thought that was just a horribly awful either miscomprehension of what the Constitution says or a misunderstanding of what open source software was. So I never had any strong political, philosophical opinion about it. So coming to WordPress, I think the bigger burden I had was that people knew that my past came from Microsoft. So they assumed that they assumed a lot of what that meant. And I've dealt with that before. I think anytime you work at a very well-known company, I mean, today anyone who's a Google employee probably deals with similar things. People presume a lot about what your attitudes are or what your philosophies are like. So I think my burden was less about culture shock for me and more about overcoming people's assumptions about being this author guy who used to work at Microsoft who's now supposed to lead a team and earning people's trust and earning their credibility. So I wasn't that shocked in terms of open source culture.
When you mentioned in the book that you actually talked to Tony Schneider at the Seaside Automattic meetup, and you brought up your observations surrounding revenue opportunities and the hard-to-find store, as if you know, you looked around and said, "What's going on here? There's so many easy ways to make money here, yet nobody is like, nah, you know, nobody's bothered with them." And Tony's response to your question was just a calm laugh, and he mentioned that he too noticed the cultural aversion to revenue. Now, can you give us a rundown of the culture you encountered while working at Automattic? I know that was one part, but it seemed to be this whole notion of, and it still continues to this day, that revenue is just a byproduct of delivering something that democratizes publishing.
Yeah, you know, that's a good thank you for reminding me of that story. That is a good example. The book talks about this at a few different points. There was just I came in, I didn't have any real preconception about philosophy. I just felt part of my job, certainly as a leader, or someone who's given a leadership role, I should say, is to make sure that the company is healthy and make sure that my salary is secure and that the people who work on my team, that their salary is secure. So just at a fundamental, basic operational sensibility, I was interested in how do we make sure the people can find the store who want upgrades. And in inquiring about that in my first few weeks, there didn't seem to be anybody else who had any concern about this at all. So I found that shocking. I was really surprised. I posted on a few P2s, which are the internal blogs, about some ideas for that. No one seemed interested. And so Tony, as a CEO, seemed like the right guy to talk to since he's involved in so many business decisions and strategic partnerships. So I had a conversation with him where I just shared my observation. And it totally made sense to him. He's worked at other companies before. He's been a leader and a founder at other companies. As a founder and CEO of a company, it's something most founders and CEOs think about a lot. So he understood my perspective, but he shared that a lot of Automattic are people who come from the open source communities. They're not as focused on revenue and money. They have higher ideals about why they're choosing to do what they do. And a lot of people started working on WordPress as a volunteer basis. And so coming to Automattic, where they're actually paid salaries to do work that they were willing to do some of on their own, their whole disposition to thinking about revenue and income is just different than your average corporation. And there are quite a – oh, go ahead.
Tony also mentioned that a lot of the employees at Automattic, this was their first chance – this was their first opportunity to work for anything close to what would be considered a corporation.
Right. Yeah, that's another surprising thing. I worked at Microsoft for years. In the decade that I've been an author and a speaker, I visit a lot of companies. I visit big companies, small ones, startups, big companies that are in other industries. So I get around. I see lots of different places and different cultures. But most employees, or at least not most, but a lot of employees at Automattic, this is the biggest company they ever worked at. So this is a big company for them, 100 people. Well, now they're just over 200. But at the time, 70 people, 80 people, that was a big company to them. They'd never worked in an organization that large. So their perspective on what was expected of them or what a company even is was very different than your average employee at your average company.
Speaking of employee numbers, when you were hired, you became the 58th employee. Now, before you, there was no team structure. Everything was just kind of flat. And I think it was because you had mentioned that doing the team structure screamed out corporate, and it was something that everybody was kind of against, something that they wanted to stay away from. However, as we see by the time we get to the end of the book, how much would you attribute the success of your experiment to the now considered normal practice of having teams with team leaders? Now that we look inside of Automattic, we kind of get a glimpse as to what's going on. There's teams everywhere with team leaders.
Yeah, so well, there's two things to admit to. So first is the book focuses heavily on my team. This is one shortcoming of a book that's written as a first person, is that there were other teams at the company. Their stories are different. They ran differently. They were organized differently. So I tell primarily the story of my team. And second, I'm biased. I was an advocate for teams. I think that it went well. I think that all the people who worked for me on the team agreed that our team worked well, and you can ask them about it. So I have a certain amount of bias in the question that you're asking. It seems a natural thing once you reach a certain size, you need to make smaller, closer locuses of control, mm-hmm. that you can't have 100 people all knocking on Matt Mullenweg or Jeff Bezos' door to say, hey, is this okay? Should I work on this next? What should I do? It can't scale. As autonomous and as independent as the kinds of employees that Automattic hires, you still have a need for local control, local influence, and that's why I think teams were inevitable. How much longer they could have gone without them, how large should the teams be, those are all open questions, and I think they'll probably continue to do more experimentation with. But I think what you're saying is true. They've adopted it. Teams is the fundamental way they now think about units of project work. I think it's good. I think it's worked out well, but I'm biased.
Yeah, we mentioned we're going to be talking about P2s here for a little while. Now, most of the communication inside of Automattic happens on something called a P2 site, which is almost like something like Twitter. It says, what are you doing? But it's a quick and easy way to find out what different people are doing, and there's so many different P2 sites inside of Automattic. But in an ironic sort of way, you listed a number of things that you disliked about P2 on a P2. What were some of those things you didn't like?
Yeah, I like these sort of meta conversations where so there's this post, it's in the book, that I rattle off some of the things that I think are problematic. I was a huge fan of P2s. I loved the way they worked. Our team did really well using that as our primary communication tool. But any online tool has limitations in certain things that can be abused. So one of the key things is just the need for interactivity, that there are some kinds of conversations that are just awful. They just totally suck if they are done in common threads on any kind of blog. And you see this happen on Huffington Post or any popular blog where you see two people going back and forth and they clearly are not listening to each other. If they got on the phone with each other and actually talked to each other in real time, they could probably figure out the assumptions that they were getting wrong about what each other were saying and resolve it in like 5 minutes. So I listed off a bunch of things like that about the unavoidable necessity for some kinds of work that requires you to talk to someone in real time at the same time. And the attempt to try to use any one medium, you're eventually going to run into the limitations of it, and wise people who are in leadership roles should be the first to say, hey, this conversation is not going well, let's switch to a different medium. That could be going from the phone to a chat room to email, but switching the medium tends to shake the tree on where the blocks are. So I advocated that people should, if they feel like they're frustrated in a conversation on a P2, to try something else.
Yeah, and because of the distributed nature of the company, Automattic is 100% distributed. There is no central office. And wanting to keep everyone on the same page, everyone in Automattic is encouraged to put everything on a P2 site. However, you, as we just mentioned, you determined that by using some private back channels of communication, you ended up receiving valuable feedback that otherwise you wouldn't have had if it was public knowledge. And I'm wondering if, based on that experience, you think should more private communication be encouraged between Automattic employees in order to get things done?
You know, it's complicated. I think any open source project has the same issues. So WordPress has a whole bunch of conversations that are done regularly in IRC, but there's back channels there too. Anyone who contributes knows this, that there's certain side conversations that go on that are not public. I think that you want to have as much stuff be public as possible for a community to function, for a community, whether that's a team or an open source project or a company. So that means that the people who have the most power should be trying to make conversations open and not hoard and privatize too many conversations. But there's a limit to that. There's certain kinds of things that people are more likely to be honest about if they know they're in a private space. So that's a judgment call thing, I think.
And I bring that up because in Matt Mulloway's State of the Word address this year at WordCamp San Francisco, he talked about the development of something called MP6, which is a plugin that is used. It's an experimental plugin that is being developed to change the look and feel of the back end of WordPress. And he had mentioned that all of the development and comments took place on a P2 website, but he had talked to Matt Thomas and others on Skype, and that conversation was not public, and he ended up getting feedback, and they ended up discussing things that maybe wouldn't have been mentioned had that conversation been in public.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's complicated. You can't, at some point, especially when you're doing something like trying to redesign something as political as the dashboard, where everyone has an opinion, and lots of people want a stake and want to be involved in. There's just too many voices. You're never going to get a good result. So you have to have some way to limit or control who's involved. It's unavoidable, especially when you're at scale. I think you have to trust leaders to have good judgment about what things they're using the back channel for. But I really don't have a puritanical view about it. Some people do. They think everything should be public. I think that's impossible. You're never going to get people's honest opinions about sensitive things if they know it's being broadcast to 50 people or 100 people.
Now, something I thought was interesting, talking about the P2 sites again, is something that deals with feedback. People would post things on a P2, and some posts would not receive any comments. And I thought it was an interesting observation you brought up, that if someone is trying to solicit feedback or shares an idea, you mentioned that there were multiple ways one could think about what zero feedback meant, such as they pass by, they look at the idea, it's good, no need for me to comment here, or maybe it's just bad, but I don't want to say it's bad because everything's public and you just ignore it. Can you elaborate on some of that a bit?
Yeah, this was fascinating. I this is true that anyone who publishes anywhere experiences this, that you work hard to come up with an idea, you post about it, and you get nothing, and you don't know, does that mean that someone read it and just thought it was stupid? Does that mean that you didn't get any traffic on it at all? Or does it mean that someone read it and had an opinion but was just afraid to post it, to post a comment? You have, as someone who publishes something, you really have no idea. And so inside Automatic, this was this thing, certainly in my first couple of months, that I noticed. Sometimes I'd post something on a P2 and I'd get a couple of comments, and sometimes I'd post something and get nothing. So that the story with Tony about the store, that was one example of this. I posted on the P2 that was about, you know, revenue, and I got nothing. Did that mean that that P2 just had fewer people reading it, or did it mean they read? But so you really don't know. And that's where having a back channel, not even a back channel, that's where having people, colleagues that you have a good enough relationship with, that you can go, hey, Fred, can you look at what I posted here? Is this, no one responded. Do you have a theory as to why? And have them tell you, well, Scott, you know, your post was kind of inflammatory, so no one wants to respond because they're upset with what you said. Having people who you can get that kind of feedback from in an online-based work environment helps tremendously. Mm-hmm. And building those relationships where you can get that kind of commentary from people is important. But I think we all deal with this on Facebook or Twitter, where sometimes you're like, that tweet that I put was so awesome, and nobody favorited it. Like, what happened? And you don't know.
It's kind of like the idea of, I've spent hours on this blog post. People are going to love this. People are going to comment on it. You put it out there, and like, all you hear is crickets for the next 2 days. And then you don't even write this another blog post that you think there's nothing to this, and that one gets all the comments. It's weird.
Yeah, and you're a freak. You're like, well, you know, it just seems kind of random. But in terms of communication inside the company, though, that was something I dealt with even with my own team. I'd post things and I'd be like, this is clearly an important post, but no one's commented. And that's when I would go on Skype or go to IRC and say, hey guys, can you go take a look at this? And they go, oh, I didn't see it. And then I get confirmation that it was simply that people are so overwhelmed with information that the fact that they didn't see something that I posted may have no bearing on what was in the post. It's just that they're following 50 P2s and they're 100 Twitter followers and they're overwhelmed by information. So it's my job, was part of my job as a leader, to make sure that they were reminded of things that were important that they might have missed.
Now, you focused on, you're part of Team Social, but overall it was for WordPress.com, and we know that improvements on WordPress.com happen all the time. It's all about incremental improvements to the software. But you've mentioned multiple times in the book about how you discovered it seemed like each feature of WordPress.com was developed in isolation, meaning interacting with that was hard to do. Why was this considered a bad thing for WordPress.com?
Well, I think it's a bad thing for WordPress in general if the goal is simplicity and ease of use. It's a common failing of open source projects because they are not designed holistically. They're not designed like an Apple product where a team of designers is sitting down and trying to think about how every little component and every dialog box, how it's all and every feature, it's all going to fit together and be coherent. Open source projects are designed, I don't want to say without any sense of coherency, but they're designed independently, that each feature and each unit is designed to solve a local problem, and you end up with a higher issue for anyone who's new to WordPress now. The dashboard is this complicated place. There's lots of terminology and things you need to know to find your way through. WordPress.com, that's where I worked, so I was responsible for that. I knew, it was clear to me and other people who have an interest in interaction design, that there are things that are really complicated that are inherited from WordPress, and we tried to figure out what we could do to simplify things and to make the most common user tasks, like getting your first post up, responding to comments. These are the things people do every day on their blog to make those easier in favor of make things that people do much less. Like a lot of the stuff in the dashboard is really settings and maintenance and development-oriented activities that most WordPress users don't do often. So yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, in the topic of you mentioned goals, and this comes from the chat room, how important do you think the town halls were to keep people working towards some common goals, such as company spirit, inclusion, and when there were no teams and after?
Well, I can't say about when there were no teams, because the first day I was hired, the first day I started, teams were already – they existed. They started about a week or two before my first day. So I can't speak about the contrast. The town halls were really interesting. They reflected Matt and Tony's general management philosophy, which was that their job was to provide some basic structure, provide resources, and hire really good people, and mostly get out of the way. So the town halls were very unusual compared to other town halls that go on at other corporations. Matt and Tony would talk about any big news that would, just like you open this podcast with like big news about big, they would open the town hall with some whatever news, if there was an acquisition or if there was a big announcement about WordPress adoption rates or percent, whatever the big thing was, they would talk about that for 10 minutes or so. And then they'd open the floor for questions and would allow anyone who had a thought or concern to speak up. And much like the P2s, where sometimes people were afraid to speak up, there were certain people who I knew probably really wanted to ask a question but were afraid to ask it in front of the whole company. Then there are other people who have a much bolder personalities, and they would ask tough questions about things that had been reported on TechCrunch or gossip about what was going on and this or that, and they would ask. And Matt and Tony were always...
I'd be that guy asking those questions.
Well, I thought that was great to see, that there are voices inside the company that would always ask some of those tough questions, and that's where the conversation would go. So there was never a town hall that I felt was critical to what my team was doing directly that changed what our goals were for the week or for the month. But I always tuned in and would listen in, and sometimes I'd ask a question, or sometimes someone would ask a question that was about what my team was working on, so I would chime in IRC with an answer. It was generally very informal. Informal and driven by the people in the company.
Also another... And you also, there's a section in the book that you talk about this, but another question from the chat room is, do you think Google Hangouts can make interaction become quicker? And he says that, I know Google uses Hangout for their distributed teams and people come and go and talk through it during the day. Seems to generate a more office feel and social connection. I know in the book you mentioned that you guys tried different technologies, but tell us how that ended up.
We were not adopters of. We tried a few different things here and there. We were really happy with the core basic trio of Skype, IRC, and the P2 blogs. That we liked it. It worked well for us. We found that we could modify the P2s to solve some more procedural problems in terms of making sure that we got for listing bugs and tracking changes. We had to make some changes, but we tried other things. They didn't really solve a problem for us. In terms of the question, I was looking at the question, Google Hangouts make interaction quicker. So Skype was usually our answer for that. If I had a question I had a bug I was trying to reproduce, I needed some help, I would just go into IRC and say, who's free? And if I couldn't find anyone there, I'd ping people individually on Skype. That worked fine most of the time. Usually we didn't have specific deadlines, so it was pretty free-flowing about when people needed to work. But if we had something we knew we were going to launch tomorrow, I would request that everyone be on at the same time. So for certain things where we needed more hands available at the same time, we would arrange that ahead of time. But usually it wasn't needed.
Right. When I read about this, I thought it was funny. But can you describe what is map bombing?
So this is... one of the challenges of working online, this is not even a challenge of working online. This is a challenge of any startup. It's a challenge of any company. That naturally, a leader of a company that's doing well, an organization that's doing well, wants to empower their employees and wants them to have autonomy and to make decisions and have a lot of authority so they can be effective. But at the same time, the founder of a company has a lot of accountability for the company and has a lot of knowledge and is good at making decisions. So there's this open question in any organization about when the CEO or an executive decides to involve themselves in a conversation and how they manage that. It's a challenge anywhere. So inside Automattic, I talked about this was one of the challenges that was observed and experienced at the company, that sometimes there'd be a conversation on a P2 about one team trying to decide an issue, and Matt would come in, and no one really knew that he was paying attention to the conversation, so he'd come in at some point, and he'd make a comment, and now everyone is kind of possibly confused, because is Matt saying that's his way is the right way, that we have to do what he's saying, or is he offering an opinion that he wants us to consider? And then no one's sure is if Matt or Tony even is continuing to listen in on the conversation and is going to follow back. So there's a certain...
I know exactly what those people are going through.
Have you experienced this yourself?
Well, you know, Matt's just the type of guy where he just comes by and writes a one-word answer, and then you don't know. It's like, okay, yeah, just like you said, I don't know what that means. I invested all this time into something, and now are you telling me that that's not the way to go? And, you know, it's
right.
Like kind of a buzzkill.
Yeah, well, it can be disorienting. But I felt that my job, part of the reason why I was an advocate for teams, is that teams have a leader, and that leader's job is to help. When there's something ambiguous happens, regardless of what it is, it could be a competitor does something that changes, that questions a plan that we have. It could be that someone we've hired to do something isn't responding to their emails anymore. Anything ambiguous that affects the team, my job as a leader was to figure it out. So one of the commentaries in the book was anytime something like that happened, whether it was Matt coming in on a thread and confusing people, or whether it was a coworker coming in on a thread and confusing people, it was my job to sort it out. That's part of the value that having teams and leaders can provide. I think that P2s or online communication makes that kind of randomization possible for anyone. Anyone who has a high reputation, that people respect what they say, if they come into a thread unannounced and jump in and offer a comment, that confuses people anyway.
Right.
So I think that's a problem you have with online work in a community. And once you have teams, that means that it's the team leader's job to do whatever they can to solve the problem. So in those cases, whenever I saw Matt do that or he confused me, I'd get him up on Skype and say, I need to sort this out. It's another example you alluded to before of using a back channel. And once I understood what was going on, I'd follow up on the thread.
Yeah, because if the team leader doesn't find out what those words meant, then you start... As a team, you start coming up with assumptions, and that's never good.
Right. And anyone could do it. I mean, I wanted to, that whole conversation I thought was important because that stuff will go on at any distributed company,
mm-hmm.
And I think actually it goes on at any company anyway. A VP can, or an executive, or a founder can respond to the 10th email in some long conversation and be. And confuse everyone, and then not respond to anything else. And everyone's wondering, what's going on? Like, is that guy still listening? That's a problem, a universal problem anyway. It's an interesting one to talk about, given that everything is on P2s at Automattic.
Now, Team Social was responsible for putting together the first versions of Jetpack, a project that everybody talked about that nobody really took a gamble on, making the big bet to actually turn the ideas into a reality. And it's been a while, and there's a lot of versions that's come out since then. What are your thoughts on Jetpack today? Have you checked it out? Have you maintained, kept tabs on its progress?
I'm a Jetpack user. I think it's great. I think the concept of it is great. I'm happy to see that the Automattic has continued to invest in it. There's a Jetpack team now, so it can make sure that that it gets updates regularly. For many developers now, it's a key part of how they develop WordPress sites for people, and the fact that there's a team now behind it that can fix bugs and deal with issues, I think, is important. So I think it's great. I think it bridges the gap between a lot of it solves a lot of basic problems that have been solved on WordPress.com that had been unavailable to the larger WordPress community, and now it gives them a choice. I think that's good.
On the flip side, the other large project you guys took over was called Highlander, and it was about unifying the common experience across WordPress.com. Do you look at that and consider that a success?
less so than Jetpack. I think our biggest ambition was really to help bloggers get more comments, and we were never able to develop the functionality. We had lots of ideas for the functionality, but the project became largely an architectural one where we had to redo how comments were architected in WordPress to allow it to be unified and have just one shared UI. The plan was that that shared UI would have a lot of really cool features that would make commenting easier and better, but we never quite got that far. I think it represented a lot of what I think there'll be more of that kind of unification, I think, on WordPress.com, simply to make the design, the user experience better. It has to be unified. But Highlander itself never resulted in a transformation of the commenting experience. So on that end, it was a failure. I think technologically it was good because now there's a platform that makes it easy if someone implements a better idea for commenting. All blogs on WordPress.com now will benefit from it. When before Highlander, it would have been something that had to be rebuilt across many different themes.
Since leaving Automattic, have you had any nightmares of intense debate?
I haven't. Okay. Yeah, not at all.
Well, Scott, I got one more question for you after this next one. I have to put on my journalism hat, and you can agree,
sure.
you can decline to answer this question or not. But earlier this week, there was a little bit of controversy when a former Automattic employee named Evan Solomon, you probably know who he is, he wrote a post that talked about how he has been immortalized in your book, The Year Without Pants, as someone who took conversations in a useless direction. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that or...
Sure, yeah, he wrote a post on Medium, I think a couple of weeks ago, and people should check it out. I could probably dig up the link. I don't have it right here, but I could put it in the chat room at least. He wrote a post about he was just really surprised that, that someone was writing a book about Automattic, and B, that it was me. He wasn't aware. And he was mostly, you should go read the post or get Evan to say exactly what the heart of what he wanted to say was. But the thrust I got from his post was he was confused and taken aback that a book like this would exist at all, that would even talk about what went on inside a company. And I can totally understand that. Writing a book about your coworkers or having a book written about a place you work is a strange experience. Rarely do most of us go through that. We all read books or read articles on TechCrunch or in magazines about companies and about what goes on there, but we imagine that somehow everyone is okay with that. When it happens to us, it's a very different experience. So I can totally understand that reaction, and I'm sure other employees at the company who were there while I was there have similarly, it's a new experience, it's a new feeling. I can totally understand that.
I just think his biggest gripe was not knowing that you were writing a book.
Yeah, and like I said, I can understand that. It's an interesting question. I spoke at Automattic, had their annual meeting a few weeks ago, and I was invited back and I talked about the book. And one question that came up there was, how and when it was disclosed that I was working on a book. And I'm not sure on the details. I know that it was common knowledge. It wasn't posted on a wall everywhere for everyone to see. But by the time I left, most people that I knew about it. My team knew about it very early on. And obviously Matt and Tony knew about it when I was hired because that was a condition of my hiring. But it was just my working assumption that most people knew I was working on the book. But some people knew at different times than other people did, and clearly Evan didn't. Apparently, Evan didn't know at all. So there are probably other people who didn't know either.
And before I get to my last question, is there any? Have you ever seen anyone play a shuffleboard like Andy Peatling? That was a really funny, incredible story because you hyped it up. You hyped it up, and I'm thinking, okay, what's going to happen here? What's going to happen here? And oh my God, he made the shot!
It's one of these stories where. I would not have believed it had someone told it to me. The funny thing is the new offices at Automattic, they have a shuffleboard there, which
yeah.
I think is great.
That's where he'll be practicing. So the last question I have for you before I let you go today is, based on your experience, do you think the way Automattic runs as a company can scale to thousands of employees? Because Matt thinks so, and he wants to see thousands of employees at Automattic. Do you think, based on your experience, can this work environment scale?
Yeah, I think that it can. I think that there is there's another company called W.L. Gore, and they have this model where they believe that the unit size for a product team is about 80 people, And whenever they grow enough, they just fork off into the unit. And so their company's a collection of these 80-person units. And whenever people – so I've gotten this question a lot because of the book. Whenever I get asked the question, I go, sure. I mean, look at Google or Microsoft. It's comprised of product teams that are about 100 or 200 people. Automatic right now is about 200 people. So if you told me, try to imagine what Automatic would be like with 400 people, I could easily imagine it as two or three units of 100 people each. And within each of those units, it functions pretty much the way the company does now. The challenge would be on Matt or on whoever he chooses to be the leader of those units to manage the autonomy that you have within the units to make sure that there's still coherency across those different product units and product teams that makes it all come together into a great product. So, of course, it can be done. I think the challenge would be on Matt and whoever his top layer, assuming that there would be one, top layer of leadership to keep everything working smoothly together.
Awesome. Scott, I want to thank you very much for your time today and for joining me and talking to me about the book. It's called The Year Without Pants, and where can people find it?
You can find it everywhere. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, independent bookstores have it, so you can get it anywhere. If you're not sure where to go, go to scottberkin.com. That's my website. You can find it there.
Scott, thanks again for joining me on the show, and all the best to you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, that was Scott Berkin, author of the book, The Year Without Pants. And before I let everybody go for this week, I want to let everyone know that next week on October 18th, our special guest will be Alex Denning, formerly of WPShout.com, and we're going to discuss the recent sale of his site to PressUp Inc., and we'll also talk about his WordPress experiences over the past 4 years and what Fred and David, the new owners, are planning on doing with the site. So that's what we're going to be doing on the show next week. So that does it for this edition of WordPress Weekly. You can find the show notes for this episode and all previous episodes on WPTavern.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeffro, that's J-E-F-F-R-0. And you can also follow Sarah, I'll do the shout out for her on Twitter, at Polly Plummer. And until next week, have a safe weekend, everybody.